I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. When William Still died 100 years ago, the New York Times called him the father of the Underground Railroad. And yet today, he's not a name we readily associate with the abolitionist movement. Our guest, Andrew Diemer, wants to give Still the recognition he deserves with his new book titled Vigilance. William Still was born in New Jersey, the youngest of 18 children. His mother was a fugitive who lived in fear of slave catchers. His father had bought his freedom. Still taught himself to read and write, and when he settled in Philadelphia, he eventually headed up the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society and the Vigilance Committee. He was instrumental in helping hundreds of enslaved people through the Underground Railroad and wrote about their harrowing and heroic experiences in his groundbreaking book titled The Underground Railroad. Andrew Diemer digs deep into Still's life to create a portrait of a complicated man and what life was like for blacks living in Philadelphia before, during, and after the Civil War. Andrew Diemer is Associate Professor of History at Towson University and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Let's begin with William Still and why he is not as well known as someone like Harriet Tubman or Frederick Douglass. I know your book is a kind of corrective to that. But why don't we know more about this man?
I think there are probably a few reasons for that. One is the nature of his work, that his work sort of puts him on the edges of some of the drama that involves fugitive slaves. So I think that's a part of it. Another part is that he, I think, doesn't put himself in the forefront. If you look at his book, the way that he tells the story of the Underground Railroad doesn't really highlight his own experience. In fact, as a historian, it can be sort of maddening to read through it and try to find him because he really isn't promoting his own role. So I think I had to do some digging to kind of understand what it was that he was doing.
In fact, you say he was an ordinary man who did extraordinary things. I mean, he seems like a pretty extraordinary man.
Yeah, you know, I hedge on that because I think he is extraordinary, but not obviously extraordinary. And I think the word that I used was seemingly. That's one of those places where the adverb is really useful because he seems ordinary, but he's not at all. He's really an extraordinary man.
Well, let's start at the beginning, the fact that he was born in the Pinelands part of New Jersey, the youngest of 18 children. What do we know about his early life?
So he grows up on a farm. So his parents had moved to this area of South Jersey in part to escape slave catchers. The first time that his mother had left, she had been recaptured, and they went to this much more remote place, a place where there were established, to a certain extent, black communities, also Quakers who sometimes were helpful in avoiding slave catchers. He grew up like a farm kid, doing farm work, helping out on his father's farm, but also helping out on neighboring farms, doing assorted work, picking cranberries, chopping wood. So all sorts of assorted work that you'd find on a farm.
Well, let me talk a bit about his parents. As you mentioned, his mother was a fugitive, had been caught and then taken back to where? Maryland?
Yes.
Where she had been enslaved.
Correct. And then she sort of spent a short period of time convincing her master that she would never do it again, the kind of play acting that enslaved people often had to do. Once that worked, she left again. But this time she made the heartbreaking decision to leave behind her two older children, boys. She brought with her the two girls who were much younger, feeling that this time there was no chance that she could leave with all four of them. And so she left them, assuming that she would never see them again.
And just to ponder and pause on that, the thought of leaving two children behind, you know, within a slavery system.
It's heartbreaking. It's also heartbreaking how common it was. This was a story that was repeated over and over again by people fleeing from slavery, that this was often the choice that they had to make.
I mean, the terrible choice. It's more than even a Sophie's choice. Well, in certain ways, it is a kind of a Sophie's choice, having to choose between your children. Now, as you mentioned, his father had actually bought his own freedom.
Correct.
How did that happen?
So this also was fairly common in the region of Maryland where they lived. So there was a kind of shifting economy in this part of Maryland, also parts of Virginia. So this was a story that we see at a lot of places in what we call the Upper South, where a shift away from like strictly tobacco monoculture towards an economy where you're growing grains, you're doing other kinds of work, had opened up opportunity for enslaved people to save up some money, and then mm-hmm. by saving some money, negotiate with masters for purchasing their freedom. And this often took very long. It was often didn't bear any fruit. Sometimes masters took advantage of this relationship, but in other cases, mm-hmm. Such as the case with Levin Steele, it worked.
Do we know what he paid for his freedom?
We do. You have to read the book. It's one of those. I have to go back and think about it. Right, it's one of those numbers that I should have off the top of my head. But yeah, so we do have. I mean, the document is extant. So you could see the document. It's in the sort of legal document that marks his freedom.
As you mentioned, this is and then Southern New Jersey, where there were some black families, some Quaker families, and I'm assuming white families as well. How much intermingling was there? Do we know?
So plenty. So, for example, when the Still children go to school, which is only sporadically, they're in a school with mostly white children, and that has bad consequences. So they find themselves discriminated against by white teachers. And in fact, Levin Sr. pulls his children out of school when he sees how they're being treated by white school teachers. So, you know, from an early age, William learns how to navigate a world in which black people and white people are living side by side, not always peacefully, but with purpose.
And do we know, I mean, this is, do we know how much they talked about, for instance, his parents talked about life for them before they came to New Jersey? Do we know if those were stories that were part of his growing up?
So we don't know too much. So neither of them have left us records directly. I think what we do know is that William grew up hearing stories about the sons that his mother had left behind. So that much we know. I think, you know, he hints at the idea that they did tell stories, that he was aware of this. Certainly they knew that she was a fugitive slave, right, as this was a secret they had to keep. You know, how deep they went into those stories is a mystery that I think we will never know. But certainly William was aware. This was not something that was hidden from him as a child.
And he taught himself to read and write.
Mostly. You know, so he had a sort of sporadic month here, month there of formal schooling. But really, he's a self-taught man.
And he comes to Philadelphia as a young man. This is, what, the early 1840s?
1844.
So what is Philadelphia like, especially for blacks at that time?
So it's a tumultuous place. So William moves into a city that is torn apart by all sorts of conflict. He actually arrives at this moment of conflict between Protestants and Catholics, immigrants and native-born white people. But he comes into a city that very recently had been torn apart by anti-black violence. The most recent at this point was 1842 riots, where black churches had been burned to the ground, where white mobs had attacked black activists sort of meeting together. So he comes into a place where he knows that it's a dangerous place. It's a place that's often hostile to African Americans and often is also hostile to just abolition in general. So we're very close to the site of the, you know, what would have been Pennsylvania Hall that was
burned
to the ground.
That's right, got burned to the ground.
So there was already a tradition of violence directed towards people like Still and people who did the work that Still was going to be involved in.
And yet there was a black middle class, as I understand it.
That's correct.
So in spite of all of this, able to make a living.
That's correct. So this points to the reason why Still came to Philadelphia in the first place. It's a city. It's a place of economic opportunity. He did not come to Philadelphia to be an abolitionist. He was an abolitionist before he came, and he would remain, but he came to Philadelphia to make money, and that's what he began to try to do, sometimes unsuccessfully for the first few years of his life.
Well, in fact, he seems like he got swindled a lot. He talks about, you know, working for somebody, and then they don't pay him.
That's right. And that shows how vulnerable free black people were, that they didn't have a lot of recourse when they were swindled. They didn't have the kind of, especially when you came from the outside, you didn't necessarily have connections and a community. And so I think, you know, eventually what Still does is he finds that community. Mm-hmm. You know, when he first moves to Philadelphia, he doesn't move into the part of the city where most free black people lived. But after a couple years, that's where he ends up.
And he also ends up working for a couple of organizations, the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society. He begins as a clerk.
Yeah, so I kind of think that that clerk thing is more telling than it might appear at first blush. So we sort of think of clerks as people who are insignificant. But what I think Still's life shows us, to come back to why he's in the background, is that he is a clerk on the Underground Railroad, but clerks were tremendously important. Clerks were the people who actually made these growing organizations of this period, whether they're businesses or whether they're the Underground Railroad, actually function on a day-to-day basis. So we should call him a clerk, but realize that being a clerk was actually a really important job.
And because you're keeping track of everything,
right.
too, right?
That's
so
right.
You know who's where, who's coming in, who's going.
Who's going in, and how much money is spent, right? This is an endeavor that costs money. That money has to be raised. It has to be accounted for to make sure that people are willing to continue to give money. And so all of this is falling onto Still's plate.
He also works with the Vigilance Committee.
So this is, you know, this is an organization that kind of unofficially operates within the Anti-Slavery Society, so it's not officially funded by it. And some of the leaders of the Anti-Slavery Society will say, well, we support the Vigilance Committee, but it's not properly anti-slavery work. So they raise their own money. It's an interracial organization, but it's an organization dominated by free black people.
Do you think that was part of the difference compared to the Anti-Slavery Society?
Well, you know, there are multiple anti-slavery societies in Philadelphia, but this one it's an interracial organization as well, but its leadership really was largely elite whites, especially Quakers. The Vigilance Committee sort of swishes the pendulum the other way, where it's interracial, but it's largely a black organization.
And at some point, he rises up to leadership of both these organizations.
So that's right. So the Vigilance Committee, he is what I tend to call the Vigilance Committee is actually technically the acting committee of the Vigilance Committee.
Okay.
So this is, you know, these complicated bureaucracies, even within an organization like the Vigilance Committee. He's the chair of the acting committee, which means that the day-to-day work of the Vigilance Committee is William Still's. Right. This is in 1852 when they reorganized this committee, which had existed in a different version earlier. Much later in his life, he will become president of the Anti-Slavery Society. At that point, it's still an important organization, but it's somewhat different. This is after the abolition of slavery, of course, where that organization is still doing important work, but it's become a little bit of a different organization.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Andrew Diemer, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about his brand new book. It's titled Vigilance, and it's subtitled The Life of William Still, Father of the Underground Railroad. You can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, talking about an important man, certainly here in the Philadelphia area, and an important piece of history for us to understand. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Andrew Diemer. He's Associate Professor of History at Towson University, and he's got a brand new book. It's titled Vigilance, The Life of William Still, Father of the Underground Railroad. Well, it's important to put all this history into some context, so we do need to spend a little time talking about the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. This was part of a compromise. Help us understand this act, and then we'll talk about its impact on Still and on Philadelphia.
Sure. It, I think, helps us understand what was so important about Still's work at this moment. So in the 1840s, let's say, states like Pennsylvania had begun to pass laws, state laws, that were intended to protect especially free black people from kidnapping, but they also essentially worked to stop the claiming of fugitive slaves. And so Southern slaveholders were increasingly frustrated with this refusal of Northern states to abide by what they believed was their constitutional obligation to return fugitive slaves. And so they pushed for strengthened national legislation, and they got it in 1850, as you said, as a part of this compromise of 1850. And so what this essentially did was created a federal bureaucracy of slave catchers, of commissioners who were empowered to seize fugitive slaves, to force citizens to help them seize fugitive slaves, and to send them back to the South. So it shows us that there's a tension between state law and federal law. It shows us that there's a tension between the population of cities like Philadelphia that increasingly is unsure about returning fugitive slaves, right, and federal legislation, and now the federal government, which is going to mandate that return.
And I'm assuming these border states, whether it's Pennsylvania, let's say Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, that those border states, that there was a lot of back and forth when it came to slave catchers and also fugitives from slavery.
That's correct. I mean, in the practical sense, this is the place where slaves are most likely to cross over, right? Right. That it's certainly possible to leave Georgia, let's say. But it's more likely that you're going to leave Maryland, that you're going to leave Delaware. And so this made this particularly contentious between these kinds of states.
So slave catchers prowling through the streets of Philadelphia?
Yeah. So there was a lot of money to be made by slave catchers. So sometimes these were police officers who were kind of entrepreneurial and willing to use their position to catch fugitive slaves and make a little extra money on the side. Sometimes these were professionals. This is what they did primarily, was catch fugitive slaves.
And I'm assuming lots of mistaken identity. You know, it's like there weren't photographs that you could
That's
use
right.
to identify somebody.
That's correct, especially in a northern state. So if you were a free black person in a southern state, a state where legal slavery still existed, you were generally sure to get some kind of evidence that you were legally free. There would be documentation that you had been emancipated, etc. Most free black people in the North didn't have this documentation. Sometimes they did, and often they could prove it, but a lot of the time you had to find testimony. You know, so if you were accused of being a fugitive slave, and in fact you were just a free black person who lived your whole life in the North, how do you prove that? Well, you've got to bring into court people who are willing to say, oh yes, this person, I've known him since he was born, his parents were free, etc. That was a difficult case to make.
Indeed. Well, you write about the fact that the quote-unquote colored citizens of Philadelphia said, quote, "We deem the laws of God at all times paramount to any human law. We shall never refuse aid and shelter and succor to any brother or sister who has escaped from the prison house of Southern bondage."
Yeah, that I think is indicative of this other development of the 1850s. And this is just a much more assertive black community, a black community that is fed up, is going to refuse to abide by this federal law, is willing to stand up and collectively act in a way that mm-hmm. prevents the enforcement of the fugitive slave law. But I would suggest also is a little bit more confident that there are more white Philadelphians on their side than had been the case, let's say, a decade earlier. I think that there's a little bit of confidence there that maybe they're winning this battle.
Was the law on their side in Pennsylvania?
So it depends. Right. So, I mean, if we take the law to mean the people who enforce the law, sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. There are some who are sympathetic to their cause and are unwilling to enforce these laws, or sometimes are willing to pass information along to William Still when they get information. There are those who take the opposite approach and insist that, no, it is our responsibility and in fact, are anti-abolition, anti-black. So it really depends on almost what judge you get, what police officer you're dealt.
Well, let's talk about the Underground Railroad. Do we know when it began, its actual beginnings?
So we don't know, and I would say that it's almost not something that we can know. So this thing that comes to be called the Underground Railroad is really, in some places, far less formal than that. So, you know, William Still is at the center of a formal network that is trying to bring order out of this crazy, improvisational, informal institution, the Underground Railroad. But it really is just people who are committed to helping fugitive slaves escape. That can take the form of a neighbor who's willing to hide you out, to give you some food, to give you some direction, or it could be something much more formal like William Still. So I think the Underground Railroad is sort of coalescing rather than just being created.
So that's what he brought to it, is to create a more, what, coherent system?
That's right. That's right. He's bringing order as a way of bringing efficiency and effectiveness to help the most people possible.
Do we know if he and Harriet Tubman's paths crossed?
Sure, they did. So she was certainly someone who worked with him. He was in communication with her. They certainly crossed paths physically on many occasions. What the nature of their personal relationship was is hard to say. Mm-hmm. They don't say that much about it, but he speaks glowingly of her and of their work together. Often she wouldn't – so she lived in Philadelphia for much of her life. You know, she lived here while she was engaged in this work, and then she would go off to different places. When she was going on her missions into the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where both of their families grew up, this is this amazing hotbed of fugitive slaves, she often didn't make it all the way back to Philadelphia. Often she would guide them as far as Wilmington, and then Thomas Garrett, who was a white ally of Still and Tubman's there, would often help kind of take them the next step, would put them on a train or in a carriage that would get them to Philadelphia. So the work that they were doing was in communication with each other. Sometimes she made it all the way to Philadelphia, and sometimes there were intermediaries.
And thinking about a sort of more organized Underground Railroad, how do people communicate with each other? How do they know that there might be a horse waiting for them by a tree to get to Philadelphia, for instance?
It comes lots of different ways. Sometimes it's informal, but increasingly it's formal. Increasingly it's coming via letters. And then Still and his allies are also seizing on this technology of the telegraph, which is enabling them to communicate even more quickly. So he has communication with people, both sort of people in places like Harrisburg who are communicating with him to say, hey, be ready, because these people are coming via the train at this time. And then Still is in communication with people further north. So many of the people that Still helps end up going to New York, and then via New York to wherever, to New England, where they're relatively safe, or to Canada, where they're much more safe. But New York is not safe for them either. So he needs to prepare the people who are his allies there to be ready, because fugitive slaves lingering around train stations is a recipe for disaster.
Indeed. But let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, that's Andrew Diemer, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the Underground Railroad and one of the important players in the Underground Railroad, William Still. And our guest's new book is titled Vigilance, The Life of William Still, Father of the Underground Railroad. And again, any questions or comments, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. He interviewed, as you mentioned, you know, so many people that were part of this Underground Railroad, finding out what their stories were about, what brought them here. One of the people that came on the Underground Railroad was a guy named Henry Brown, known as Henry Box Brown. What should we know about him?
So Brown was enslaved in Richmond, Virginia. So he was owned by a man who worked him in a tobacco factory. So he was kind of typical slave of the urban South. What was also typical about Brown is that his wife was owned by a different master. This was often the case. And that meant that their children were owned by this different master. And so when that master decided to sell Brown's wife and children, there was nothing that Brown or even his master could do about it. They were separated. And obviously, this is devastating to Henry Brown. And as was often the case in instances like this, this became the spark for him to run away. So often what was keeping people who might otherwise have run away was that they knew that they would be leaving family members behind. Now, Brown decided that my family's gone. I might as well take my chance. Easier said than done, right? It's not so easy to run away, even from a place like Richmond, which is not the Deep South, but is not exactly on the border. And so he arranged with a white associate to have himself sealed inside a crate and mailed to Philadelphia, which they knew was a safe place or a safer place for him. This had become more feasible because transportation had improved. So the path from Richmond to Philadelphia at this point took about 24 hours, which again is not nothing, but is better than it would have been years earlier. Unfortunately for Henry Brown, the crate was turned over at one point, so he spent the last portion of this journey uncomfortably on his shoulder. But when he arrived in Philadelphia, the Anti-Slavery Society sent someone to the depot and had him brought to the office. And there's this sort of vivid picture that's depicted in a number of prints from the era of these men, including Still, standing around the crate, kind of anxiously waiting to see what happens. And they knock on it, and they hear Brown's voice, and they pry open the crate, and out he pops. I think he then collapses from exhaustion. But there's this moment of triumph where he has this hymn that he's prepared to sing at the time. I mean, it's this really dramatic and moving moment. But I think what it is interesting, what it tells us about Still is a little bit of his role in the Underground Railroad, right? That he is not the one who physically is transporting Henry Brown. Henry Brown is doing that. He's the one taking the risk. And in fact, the man, his ally in the South, is taking a much greater risk because he's actually ultimately imprisoned trying to repeat this task with someone else. But Still's work is to be there, to support, to make sure that when Brown gets to Philadelphia, that he has a safe place. Brown actually stays with Stills for a few days while he recuperates, and then they send him north where he's going to be safer. Mm. So this is a kind of example of how Still is in the background but actually doing really important work.
As you mentioned, Henry Brown's family was taken away, and you include, I guess, one of his descriptions with ropes about their necks and staples on their arms. Just the horror of having your children and your wife, in his case, dragged away, obviously imagining what their future was going to be.
This is a kind of horror that had become all too common. So people like Henry Brown saw this kind of thing happen every day, and I would have to imagine had become kind of numb to it. But then when it's your family, all of a sudden it's shocking all again. It's horrific.
Absolutely. There's another really interesting celebrated case, and this is a woman named Jane Johnson who was traveling through Philadelphia. I think it tells us something else about William Still. It's a rather complicated story, but it's worth hearing.
So in this instance, Still was sitting in his office. So this shows us again that Still's work was the work of a clerk, where he's sitting there engaging with his correspondence, and into the office walks a boy who drops a note on his desk saying, "Come to Bloodgood's Hotel. There's a woman here who wants her freedom." And Still kind of springs into action. So this shows us he's got this network. People bring him information, but also that he's got to act on it. And so he runs to this hotel, which is near the Walnut Street Pier, and an ally of his, Passmore Williamson, the only white man on the acting committee of the Vigilance Committee, meets him there, and they don't find the woman in question, but they're told that she's already gone to the ferry. So at this point, to get to New York, you had to take a ferry across the Delaware, where you would then catch a train that would take you the rest of the way. So they want to catch her while she's still on the ferry, while she's still in Philadelphia. They get to the top deck of the ferry, and they see this woman who they're guessing is this woman, who turns out to be Jane Johnson. Of course, they didn't know what her name was at the time. And a man that they assume to be her master is standing next to her. And Still and Williamson approach her, and they say, "Is this man your master?" And she says, "He is." They ask her if she wants to be free, and she says that she does. And they inform her that she is already free. Now, this comes back to the laws of Pennsylvania. So Pennsylvania, of course, by this point had abolished slavery. But when they abolished slavery, they had included a provision that allowed masters to bring slaves in transit. So you could pass through the state. It was legal to do so as long as you didn't stay too long. Now, that provision had been repealed. So at this point, just by stepping foot on
the
soil, she was free, legally free. But if her master kept her and then she returned to some place where slavery was legal, that wouldn't be the case. So what Still and Williamson say to her is that you need to take the initiative. We can't do this for you, but if you take this initiative, we will help you. And she walks towards them. Her master tries to grab her. And even before Still and Williamson can do anything, this crowd of black men who had gathered collapse on the master and allow Jane to escape with Still, who sort of takes her away and secrets her somewhere in Philadelphia. So again, we see all the functioning of the Underground Railroad here, even though this is not a fugitive slave case. We see the gathering of information. We see Still taking action. We see this understanding of the law of Pennsylvania. We also see a black community that is making that work possible. It's unclear what would have happened I think we can imagine that Still and Williamson would have sort of used their physical force to prevent her from being recaptured. But in place of that, we see the black community that has just sort of coalesced here helping them in this work.
And there's a trial, too.
There is a trial. So turns out this guy, John Wheeler, is a really important man. Yeah. So he's the minister to Nicaragua, the U.S. minister to Nicaragua. He had dinner with the president in the White House the night before. This is a sort of man who's not willing to let this go easily. And so he leans on his influence in Philadelphia to have these men brought to trial, claiming essentially that they had assaulted him, saying that they had forced Jane Johnson to escape. This is a kind of old slaveholder rhetoric, saying she wouldn't have left on her own. She was happy with me. These men forced her to do this. So the men who had captured him were put on trial, Still is eventually put on trial. Williamson is actually jailed for supposedly contempt of court. In the end, they're all set free. And so we see the legal process playing out in Still's favor. But certainly it shows us how contentious this moment is.
Well, indeed. And we're almost up in a break here. But and she speaks, Jane Johnson speaks in the trial in, as you write, most eloquent terms.
It must have been a very dramatic moment
for
this woman. The center of all this conflict, to have come back from where she had gone, New York, and then even further to testify at this trial, must have been a really dramatic moment.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take that very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about the extraordinary life of William Still. If you live here in Philadelphia, that name might ring a bell, but you might not know all the details of his life and the important role that he played in the Underground Railroad, also the integration of trolley cars here in Philadelphia, and much more as well. And again, Andrew Diemer is our guest, and his new book is titled Vigilance, The Life of William Still, Father of the Underground Railroad. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. If you're just joining us, Andrew Diemer is our guest. He's an associate professor of history at Towson University, and we've been talking about his new book titled Vigilance, The Life of William Still, Father of the Underground Railroad. Let me read an email from Joy, who says, I was doing research into the Underground Railroad coming through Philadelphia and went to find William Still's house. It was incredibly disappointing to find that the home is not identified as a historical building, no markers or anything. He lived in a number of places in Philadelphia, Andrew.
That's correct. The house that does have a marker is on 12th Street, and that is not a house that he lived in while he was aiding fugitive slaves. That was a house that he and Letitia lived in later in life. They lived in a few different houses while they were aiding fugitive slaves that are not marked. There was a house, I don't believe this house is actually still standing, on what is now Rodman Street. So if you know that street, Little Street, just north of South Street. They lived in a house on what then was called Ronaldson Street, is now Delhi Street, just north of Palumbo Park. That house is still standing and was recently identified by preservation activists, and hopefully someday that there will, before too long, there will be a plaque there. The Stills also operated a boarding house on South Street around 9th, and that does not have a plaque either, but it should. So hopefully we can get to work on that and get some identification of these important locations in the Still story.
Let me ask you about another story, and this involves his brother Peter. And Peter, I guess, was one of the brothers that the mother had to leave behind when she escaped to New Jersey. Is that correct?
That's correct. So Peter and his brother Levin, so named after their father, were sold very quickly south. I suspect that the master was afraid that that their mother would come back for them. In any case, he wanted to be rid of them, and so they were sold south, eventually ending up in Alabama. Peter was able to, over the course of many years, save enough money to purchase his own freedom. In the meantime, Levin had died. And so Peter, having lost his brother, was interested in, now that he was a free man, going to find his family. But he didn't really know much about his family at all because he'd been separated from them at such a young age. And so he headed to Philadelphia. And he really, all he knew was that his family had lived near the Delaware River. That's really all he had to go on. And so he goes to Philadelphia and people say, well, we're not sure we can help you, but you go see this guy, William Still. So he walks into the office and tells him that he's here for this purpose. And William begins to ask him questions. And this amazing moment happens where, you know, Peter begins telling him the name of his parents, same name as William Still. He begins to tell him when he had been separated from them. And all of a sudden it falls into place. And William realizes that this man sitting before him is in fact the brother that he has never met, the brother that he assumed he would never meet.
That's how your book begins.
That's how I begin. I think it. I love it because it's so dramatic. It also just tells us so much, right? It talks us about how families are being separated by slavery. It talks to us about the work that William is doing, that he's built this network, that there is a reason why, in other words, Peter walks into his office that day. It's not an accident. It's because William has put himself at the center of this network. It also, I think, you know, it shows to me that William Still's abolition, that his Underground Railroad work was always rooted in his family, right? That he is driven to it by the stories of his mother, the fact that his mother's a fugitive slave. He tells us stories that as a young boy, he was engaged in helping fugitive slaves in New Jersey, helping family members guide fugitive slaves to safety. Even before this reconciliation with his brother, it's a very personal thing to him.
Yeah,
it's a family thing to him.
And sadly, the other brother who was left behind is what, either whipped to death or beaten to death or
yeah.
Obviously a very tragic ending for him.
Yeah, it's sort of, it captures the horror and the magic of this story, right? That it's both of these things. It's amazing stories of triumph and reconciliation, but also of tragedy and separation and destruction.
Yeah. Here's an email from Angela. She says, I'm a direct descendant of Still's brother James and his mother and father Charity and Levin. My paternal great-great-great-grandparents, proud to know many of these stories, Vigilance highlights, and hold a copy of Still's book Underground Railroad, which is now out of print. Curious if, Andrew, that would be you, interviewed any Still family members as part of your research?
So I didn't interview per se. I talked to Samuel Still, who's also a descendant of James, and had him read the manuscript. So I am aware of this sort of amazing Still family and the amazing stories that they tell. It's difficult to wade into this world of oral history. I mean, there's this rich oral history, and you know, one of the things about writing a book is that you have to make choices. And I think there's a huge story to be told of the Still family writ large. I think it's a remarkable family. I talk about Still's immediate family in this book, his daughters and sons, but not too much. I think that there's a lot more to be written about the Still family, and hopefully someone will pick that up and tell this fuller story of the Still family.
Well, you mentioned his children. Caroline became a doctor, William a lawyer, Robert a journalist, and Francis a teacher. I mean, that tells you a lot, doesn't it?
It does. You know, and I think part of this story, so we've emphasized the anti-slavery aspect of it, the Underground Railroad, but, you know, I said that Still came to Philadelphia to make money. That was his number one ambition, and being an abolitionist was just part of who he was. He wouldn't give up on that ambition to become wealthy, and he became quite wealthy. I think he always saw that as connected to his activism. You know, William was of a class of the sort of black middle class that was quite conscious of how they were being judged. They felt like any misstep, any misbehavior would reflect on all black people. And so they felt like it was really their responsibility to live this morally upright life, but upright in other ways as well, kind of very disciplined, hardworking, and success was therefore reflecting on not just William Still, but all Black people.
And you said respectability. That seemed to be the sort of driving word for him.
That's right. There was a great belief that if we could live a respectable life, that that would accomplish something beyond what it accomplished just for us.
I mentioned this before going on the air. There's just a little section where and the Stills would shelter people who were part of the Underground Railroad, and there were just a number of little notes saying, and make sure you thank Mrs. Still for her generosity and her good cooking and her welcoming of us. It was just a paragraph there, but I think quite revealing.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we can, again, imagine what fugitive slaves were going through, right? One of the most difficult things that they did, aside from just the sheer physical difficulty of traveling the road that took them to Philadelphia, was to leave family members behind. And I think that arriving in Philadelphia and finding themselves welcomed into this home where Letitia had created this nice domestic world and there were small children, I think it meant a lot. And we see this in letters written to William years later. They will often write back and say, remember me to Letitia. This was the most wonderful time that I've ever spent in my life, seeing you and your wonderful children. It really was meaningful, and it comes back to this connection between family and the work that William was doing.
They also sheltered part of John Brown's family.
Yes.
Was that a little out of character, just because that was obviously such a dramatic and explosive thing that John Brown did at Harper's Ferry?
Well, it's out of character in a certain way, in that, you know, Still's work is not marked by the kind of violence that became the hallmark of John Brown's abolitionist career. But, you know, we know that Brown's staunchest allies were Black abolitionists. He trusted them. They identified with him even when they didn't approve of all of his methods. And so it's probably unsurprising that when he was planning his Harper's Ferry raid, he came to Philadelphia and the people he wanted to meet with were Black abolitionists like William Still. And there's this meeting where Still and other Black leaders are there. Frederick Douglass is there, even though he's not a Philadelphian. But it's clear that Brown wants buy-in from these Black leaders. I think he also wants Still in particular because Still is adept at navigating this borderland. Even though Harper's Ferry is a little bit out of his wheelhouse, he understands moving back and forth across these borders. And I think that for that reason, he really wants Still on his side. Still, I think, is ultimately skeptical of this plan. He ultimately doesn't think it's really going to work, ultimately counsels against it. But of course, Brown moves ahead, nevertheless, as Brown will do.
Yeah. Here's an email from Susan. My brother married Tracy Still, who's a descendant of either William Still or brother James, who's also an amazing man. Tracy's not sure which one. There are a lot of Still descendants. And if you're one of 18 children, then that's got to be true.
Of course. Yeah, so I didn't even mention. So James Still is this wonderful story. He's a self-taught herbalist and he becomes a physician and operates a medical practice in South Jersey. So there are many amazing stories to be told about the Still family.
Here's another one. Jane says, William's brother James Still was the, quote, Black doctor of the Pines, well-skilled in botanical medicine, and his home and office are historical buildings in Medford, New Jersey.
They are. And hopefully, I've been talking to Samuel Still, who operates that, and hopefully we're going to do an event there before too long.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's talk about integrating the trolley cars in Philadelphia, and William Still played such an important role doing that.
So in the period that we're talking about, the period of the Underground Railroad and then the Civil War and afterwards, Philadelphia was booming, right? So Philadelphia was growing. It was growing economically. It was growing in terms of its population, and that population was sprawling beyond the original boundaries of the city. All of this means people need to move more effectively. So the public transit of this moment is what were known as streetcars. So these were carriages that ran on rails that were pulled by horses. So these were not yet powered by locomotives. They were pulled by horses, but they were much faster because they're running on rails. Black Philadelphians were allowed to ride these cars, but they had to ride on the outside. So there was a platform on the outside, and they were forced to ride there, which, as you can imagine, in inclement weather is awful, and in any case is humiliating.
Dangerous,
humiliating and dangerous, that's right. And so alongside of the push against slavery that we can see the Underground Railroad as a part of, abolitionists had always advocated for citizenship rights, black equality, and this becomes a cause that still really begins to advocate in the late 1850s. So even before he's stopped doing his work on the Underground Railroad, he is writing letters to the newspaper, beginning to gather public support for his cause to desegregate these streetcars. Now, still is a small part of this bigger story. There are lots of different activist pieces here, but certainly he is he's kind of relentless on this cause throughout the 1860s, and I think is a big part of why in 1867 the state legislature mm-hmm. passes a law that bans this kind of segregation. So it's a kind of triumphal story of this particular civil rights issue.
Indeed. So how does he live out the remainder of his life after the Civil War, after the end of the Underground Railroad? He's obviously making money. He's a wealthy man.
That's right. So he's a man of a few different hats. So his business is always a priority for him, and this takes a huge amount of his time. As I mentioned, he's also a civil rights activist, so he's involved in a number of organizations that are pushing for the desegregation of streetcars. He's pushing for the right to vote for black people, which had been denied them since the Constitution of 1838. In keeping with this emphasis on respectability, he pushes for what was called like uplift. You know, he's interested in promoting literary excellence. So he's a patron of Francis Ellen Watkins. He believes in kind of showcasing the capabilities of black people. He's also eventually, as he becomes wealthy, becomes a philanthropist and he's willing to spread his money around. He funds a house for sort of indigent elderly people. He sort of funds houses for orphans. This is especially important after the Civil War, where there are lots of black orphans. But I think the other thing that he spends his later years doing is telling the stories of the Underground Railroad via what we've already mentioned, which is this book that he publishes in 1871, 1872. This is this massive 800-page volume. If you see the originals, they have these beautiful leather covers. I mean, there's a real emphasis on creating a beautiful object, but the most important thing are the stories within this book.
And there are hundreds of stories, correct?
Hundreds of stories. And I think it's in keeping with Still's desire to sort of put himself in the background, but to really make sure that the fugitive slaves themselves are at the forefront, that this is really a book about individuals who had been enslaved and are able to become free via much of their own work.
And the title was The Underground Railroad, A Record of Facts, Authentic Narratives, Letters, etc., narrating the hardships, hairbreadth escapes, and death struggles of the slaves in their efforts for freedom.
Yeah, so in addition to the stories he tells, it includes a lot of the kind of raw evidence that he had used to compile this. So there are lots of letters. There are some newspaper clippings. There are, you know, this is all a way of kind of showing his authenticity, right? That he's putting this out there to show that I was really there. Even if he's not going to tell his story within this book, he wants it to be clear that he's there, that he's got the receipts.
And in 20 seconds or less, how should we remember William Still?
I think we should remember William Still as a remarkable man who is not obviously remarkable, but was able to do remarkable things, and a man who was committed to the work of aiding fugitive slaves throughout his life.
Well, we have to leave it there. Andrew Diemer, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It was a blast.
Good for us as well to always learn about important people in our history. And again, Andrew Diemer's book is titled Vigilance, subtitled The Life of William Still, Father of the Underground Railroad. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.